Chapter 9. The aunts and uncles are coming. It was Easter week, and Mrs. Tulliver's cheesecakes were more exquisitely light than usual. A puff o' wind would make 'em blow about like feathers, Kezia the housemaid said, feeling proud to live under a mistress who could make such pastry, so that no season or circumstances could have been more propitious for a family party, even if it had not been advisable to consult Sister Glegg and Sister Pullet about Tom's going to school. I'd as lief not invite Sister Dean this time, said Mrs. Tulliver, for she's as jealous, and having as can be, and Zelay's trying to make the worst o' my poor children to their aunts and uncles. Yes, yes, said Mr. Tulliver, ask her to come. I never hardly get a bit o' talk with Dean now, we haven't had him this 6 months. What's it matter what she says? My children need be beholding to nobody. That's what you allay say, Mr. Tulliver, but I'm sure there's nobody o' your side, neither aunt nor uncle, to leave 'em so much as a £5 note for a legacy. And there's Sister Glegg, and Sister Pullet too, saving money unknown, for they put by all their own interest and butter money too. Their husbands buy 'em everything. Mrs. Tulliver was a mild woman, but even a sheep will face about a little, when as he has lambs. Chuh! Said Mr. Tulliver. It takes a big loaf, when there's many to breakfast. What signifies your sister's bits o' money, when they've got half a dozen nevies, and nieces to divide it among? And your sister Dean won't get 'em to leave all to one, I reckon, and make the country cry shame on 'em when they are dead? I don't know what she won't get 'em to do, said Mrs. Tulliver, for my children are so awkward why their aunts and uncles. Maggie's 10 times naughtier when they come than she is other days, and Tom doesn't like 'em, bless him. Though it's more natural in a boy than a gel. And there's Lucy Dean, such a good child, you may set her on the stool, and there she'll sit for an hour together, and never offer to get off. I can't help loving the child, as if she was my own, and I'm sure she's more like my child than Sister Dean's, for she delays a very poor color for one of our family, Sister Dean had. Well, well, if you're fond o' the child, ask her father and mother to bring her with 'em. And won't you ask their aunt and Uncle Moss too, and some o' their children? Oh, dear, Mr. Tulliver, why, there'd be 8 people besides the children, and I must put 2 more leaves i' the table, besides reaching down more o' the dinner service. And you know as well as I do as my sisters, and your sister don't suit well together. Well, well, do as you like, Bessie, said Mr. Tulliver, taking up his hat and walking out to the mill. Few wives were more submissive than Mrs. Tulliver on all points unconnected with her family relations. But as he had been a Miss Dodson, and the Dodsons were a very respectable family indeed, as much looked up to as any in their own parish, or the next to it. The Miss Dodsons had always been thought to hold up their heads very high, and no one was surprised the 2 eldest had married so well, not at an early age, for that was not the practice of the Dodson family. There were particular ways of doing everything in that family. Particular ways of bleaching the linen, of making the cowslip wine, curing the hams, and keeping the bottled gooseberries, so that no daughter of that house could be indifferent to the privilege of having been born a Dodson, rather than a Gibson or a Watson. Funerals were always conducted with peculiar propriety in the Dodson family. The hatbands were never of a blue shade, the gloves never split at the thumb, everybody was a mourner who ought to be, and there were always scarfs for the bearers. When one of the family was in trouble or sickness, all the rest went to visit the unfortunate member, usually at the same time, and did not shrink from uttering the most disagreeable truths that correct family feeling dictated. If the illness or trouble was the sufferer's own fault, it was not in the practice of the Dodson family to shrink from saying so. In short, there was in this family a peculiar tradition as to what was the right thing in household management and social demeanor, and the only bitter circumstance attending this superiority was a painful inability to approve the condiments or the conduct of families ungoverned by the Dodson tradition. a female Dodson, when in strange houses, always ate dry bread with her tea, and declined any sort of preserves, having no confidence in the butter, and thinking that the preserves had probably begun to ferment from want of due sugar and boiling. There were some Dodsons less like the family than others, that was admitted. But in so far as they were in, they were of necessity better than those who were o'kin. And it is remarkable, that while no individual Dodson was satisfied with any other individual Dodson, each was satisfied, not only with him or herself, but with the Dodsons collectively. The feeblest member of a family, the one who has the least character, is often the merest epitome of the family habits and traditions. And Mrs. Tulliver was a thorough Dodson, though a mild one, as small beer, so long as it is anything, is only describable as very weak ale. And though as he had groaned a little in her youth under the yoke of her elder sisters, and still shed occasional tears at their sisterly reproaches, it was not in Mrs. Tulliver to be an innovator on the family ideas. She was thankful to have been a Dodson, and to have one child who took after her own family, at least in his features and complexion, in liking salt and in eating beans, which a Tulliver never did. In other respects, the true Dodson was partly latent in Tom, and he was as far from appreciating his in on the mother's side as Maggie herself, generally absconding for the day with a large supply of the most portable food. When he received timely warning that his aunts and uncles were coming, a moral symptom from which his aunt Glegg deduced the gloomiest views of his future. It was rather hard on Maggie that Tom always absconded without letting her into the secret, but the weaker sex are acknowledged to be serious impedimenta in cases of flight. On Wednesday, the day before the aunts and uncles were coming, there were such various and suggestive scents, as of plum cakes in the oven and jellies in the hot state, mingled with the aroma of gravy, that it was impossible to feel altogether gloomy. There was hope in the air. Tom and Maggie made several inroads into the kitchen, and, like other marauders, were induced to keep aloof for a time only by being allowed to carry away a sufficient load of booty. "Tom," said Maggie, as they sat on the boughs of the elder tree, eating their jam puffs, "shall you run away tomorrow?" "No," said Tom, slowly, when he had finished his puff, and was eyeing the third, which was to be divided between them. "Oh, I shan't." "Why, Tom?" "Because Lucy's coming?" "No," said Tom, opening his pocket knife and holding it over the puff, with his head on one side in a dubitative manner. It was a difficult problem, to divide that very irregular polygon into two equal parts. "What do I care about Lucy? She's only a girl, she can't play at bandy." "Is it the tipsy cake, then?" said Maggie, exerting her hypothetic powers, while she leaned forward toward Tom with her eyes fixed on the hovering knife. "No, you silly, that'll be good the day after. It's the puddin'. I know what the puddin's to be, apricot roll up o' my buttons." With this interjection, the knife descended on the puff, and it was in two, but the result was not satisfactory to Tom, for he still eyed the halves doubtfully. At last he said, "Shut your eyes, Maggie." "What for?" "You never mind what for. Shut 'em when I tell you." Maggie obeyed. "Now, which'll you have, Maggie, right hand or left?" "I'll have that with the jam run out," said Maggie, keeping her eyes shut to please Tom. "Why, you don't like that, you silly. You may have it, if it comes to you fair, but I shan't give it you without. Right or left, you choose now." "Hi-yay," said Tom, in a tone of exasperation, as Maggie peeped. "Why you keep your eyes shut now, else you shan't have any." Maggie's power of sacrifice did not extend so far. Indeed, I fear she cared less that Tom should enjoy the utmost possible amount of puff, than that he should be pleased with her for giving him the best bit. So she shut her eyes quite close, till Tom told her to a which, and then she said, "Left hand." "You've got it," said Tom, in rather a bitter tone. "What, the bit with the jam run out?" "No, here, take it," said Tom, firmly, handing, decidedly the best piece to Maggie. "Oh please, Tom, have it. I don't mind, I like the other. Please take this. No, I shan't, said Tom, almost crossly, beginning on his own inferior piece. Maggie, thinking it was no use to contend further, began to, and ate up her half puff with considerable relish as well as rapidity. But Tom had finished first, and had to look on while Maggie ate her last morsel or two, feeling in himself a capacity for more. Maggie didn't know Tom was looking at her. She was seesawing on the elder bough, lost to almost everything but a vague sense of jam and idleness. Oh, you greedy thing, said Tom, when he had swallowed the last morsel. He was conscious of having acted very fairly, and thought she ought to have considered this, and made up to him for it. He would have refused a bit of hers beforehand, but one is naturally at a different point of view before and after one's own share of puff is swallowed. Maggie turned quite pale. Oh, Tom, why didn't you ask me? I wasn't going to ask you for a bit, you greedy. You might have thought of it without, when you knew I gave you the best bit. But I wanted you to have it, you know I did, said Maggie, in an injured tone. Yes, but I wasn't going to do what wasn't fair, like Spouncer. He always takes the best bit, if you don't punch him for it, and if you choose the best with your eyes shut, he changes his hands. But if I go halves, I'll go 'em fair, only I wouldn't be a greedy. With this cutting innuendo, Tom jumped down from his bough, and threw a stone with a oi, as a friendly attention to Yap, who had also been looking on while the eatables vanished, with an agitation of his ears and feelings which could hardly have been without bitterness. Yet the excellent dog accepted Tom's attention with as much alacrity as if he had been treated quite generously. But Maggie, gifted with that superior power of misery which distinguishes the human being, and places him at a proud distance from the most melancholy chimpanzee, sat still on her bough, and gave herself up to the keen sense of unmerited reproach. She would have given the world, not to have eaten all her puff, and to have saved some of it for Tom. Not but that the puff was very nice, for Maggie's palate was not at all obtuse, but she would have gone without it many times over, sooner than Tom should call her greedy, and be cross with her. And he had said he wouldn't have it, and she ate it without thinking. How could she help it? The tears flowed so plentifully that Maggie saw nothing around her for the next 10 minutes, but by that time resentment began to give way to the desire of reconciliation, and she jumped from her bough to look for Tom. He was no longer in the paddock behind the rickyard. Where was he likely to be gone, and Yap with him? Maggie ran to the high bank against the great holly tree, where she could see far away toward the floss. There was Tom, but her heart sank again as she saw how far off he was on his way to the great river, and that he had another companion besides Yap, naughty Bob Jackin, whose official, if not natural, function of frightening the birds was just now at a standstill. Maggie felt sure that Bob was wicked, without very distinctly knowing why, unless it was because Bob's mother was a dreadfully large fat woman, who lived at a queer round house down the river, and once, when Maggie and Tom had wandered thither, there rushed out a brindle dog that wouldn't stop barking. And when Bob's mother came out after it, and screamed above the barking, to tell them not to be frightened, Maggie thought she was scolding them fiercely, and her heart beat with terror. Maggie thought it very likely that the roundhouse had snakes on the floor, and bats in the bedroom, for as he had seen Bob take off his cap, to show Tom a little snake that was inside it, and another time he had a handful of young bats. Altogether, he was an irregular character, perhaps even slightly diabolical, judging from his intimacy with snakes and bats. And to crown all, when Tom had Bob for a companion, he didn't mind about Maggie, and would never let her go with him. It must be owned that Tom was fond of Bob's company. How could it be otherwise? Bob knew, directly he saw a bird's egg, whether it was a swallow's, or a tomtit's, or a yellowhammer's. He found out all the wasps' nests, and could set all sort of traps. He could climb the trees like a squirrel, and had quite a magical power of detecting hedgehogs and stoats. And he had courage to do things that were rather naughty, such as making gaps in the hedgerows, throwing stones after the sheep, and killing a cat that was wandering incognito. Such qualities in an inferior, who could always be treated with authority in spite of his superior knowingness, had necessarily a fatal fascination for Tom, and every holiday time Maggie was sure to have days of grief, because he had gone off with Bob. Well, there was no hope for it. He was gone now, and Maggie could think of no comfort but to sit down by the hollow, or wander by the hedgerow, and fancy it was all different, refashioning her little world into just what she should like it to be. Maggie's was a troublous life, and this was the form in which she took her opium. Meanwhile Tom, forgetting all about Maggie and the sting of reproach which he had left in her heart, was hurrying along with Bob, whom he had met accidentally, to the scene of a great rat catching in a neighboring barn. Bob knew all about this particular affair, and spoke of the sport with an enthusiasm which no one who is not either divested of all manly feeling, or pitiably ignorant of rat catching, can fail to imagine. For a person suspected of preternatural wickedness, Bob was really not so very villainous looking. There was even something agreeable in his snub-nosed face, with its close-curled border of red hair. But then his trousers were always rolled up at the knee, for the convenience of waiting on the slightest notice, and his virtue, supposing it to exist, was undeniably virtue in rags, which, on the authority even of bilious philosophers, who think all well-dressed merit overpaid, is notoriously likely to remain unrecognized, perhaps, because it is seen so seldom. "I know the chap as owns the ferrets," said Bob, in a hoarse treble voice, as he shuffled along, keeping his blue eyes fixed on the river, like an amphibious animal who foresaw occasion for darting in. "He lives up the kennel yard at Suddog's, he does. He's the biggest rat catcher anywhere, he is. I'd sooner be a rat catcher nor anything, I would. The moles is nothing to the rats. But lors, you mun ha ferrets. Dogs is no good. Why, there's that dog, now," Bob continued, pointing with an air of disgust toward Yap. "He's no more good why a rat nor nothing. I see it myself, I did, at the rat catchin' I your faither's barn." Yap, feeling the withering influence of this scorn, tucked his tail in and shrank close to Tom's leg, who felt a little hurt for him, but had not the superhuman courage to seem behindhand with Bob in contempt for Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.